This recording was made in Great Britain by the Medical Recording Service of the College of General Practitioners. The recording and production by Drs. John and Valerie Graves. Copyright reserved. The diagnosis of acute cardiac infarction. The speaker is Dr. William Clark, consultant cardiologist at the Royal Northern Hospital, London.
I should like to make a few remarks on the history and etiology of coronary artery disease and give a more complete account of its differential diagnosis. It is within the clinical lifetime of many of us that this condition has reared its ugly head so vigorously, and its incidence has become so high that it may truly be called the plague of modern civilization. Isolated case reports appeared at sporadic intervals, and William Harvey, almost 300 years ago, writing to one of his strongest critics in France, one Monsieur Riolin Jr., described a case of left ventricular rupture, due, he surmised in his own words, to obstruction of the passage of blood from the left ventricle to the arteries. The patient was one Sir Thomas Darcy, who, as Harvey says, when he reached the middle period of his life, made frequent complaints of a certain distressing pain in the chest, especially in the night season, so that, dreading at one time syncope, at another suffocation in his attacks, he led an inquiet and anxious life. It is evident, therefore, that the poor man also had angina. Jenner, describing the post-mortem findings in the case of his friend William Hunter, correctly assumed that the calcified arteries were the cause of his friend's anginal attacks. One of the best descriptions I have read of angina was written by William Hebden. He said, "But there is a disorder of the breast, marked with strong and peculiar symptoms, considerable for the kind of danger belonging to it, and not extremely rare, which deserves to be mentioned more at length. The seat of it, and the sense of strangling and anxiety with which it is attended, may make it not improperly be called angina pectoris. They who are afflicted with it are seized while they are walking, more especially if it be uphill and soon after eating, with a painful and most disagreeable sensation in the breast, which seems as if it would extinguish life if it were to increase or continue. But the moment they stand still, all this uneasiness vanishes. In all other respects, the patients are at the beginning of this disturbance perfectly well, and in particular have no shortness of breath, from which it is totally different. The pain is sometimes situated in the middle, sometimes at the bottom of the os sterni, and often more inclined to the left than to the right side. It likewise very frequently extends from the breast to the middle of the left arm. The pulse is at least sometimes not disturbed by this pain, as I have had opportunity of observing by feeling the pulse during the paroxysm. Males are most liable to that disease, especially such as have passed their 50th year. After it has continued a year or more, it will not cease so instantaneously upon standing still, and it will come on not only when the persons are walking, but when they are lying down, especially when they lie on their left side, and oblige them to rise up out of their beds. In some inveterate cases, it has been brought on by the motion of a horse or a carriage, and even by swallowing, coughing, going to stool, or speaking, or any disturbance of the mind. More and more cases were described before death, but it is not until 1912 that James Herrick clearly described the classical symptoms of cardiac infarction. At that time, differential diagnosis was wide, and one could not be certain of the true state of affairs. In 1898, for instance, the Russian physician Ampeln, writing from St. Petersburg, mentioned acute gallbladder disease, hemorrhagic pancreatitis, perforation of the stomach, or bowel obstruction, as conditions that might be mistaken for cardiac infarction. It was only with the use of the electrocardiograph machine that diagnosis became precise. In the early 1900s, This was more an instrument of research than a routine clinical method of investigation. In 1920, Pardee described the classical ST elevation that occurs with acute infarction, and following this, the condition became more and more frequently recognized. In the middle 20s, it was being diagnosed with increasing correctness and confidence. As well as this, however, there is a rapidly increasing incidence of the condition in all civilized countries. Although heredity is so important, it seems to be a risk associated with our way of life. People from countries where the incidence is low are at equal risk when they join our community. In considering the history of the condition, there is a surprisingly modern ring about the statement of William Osler, writing in 1896 on angina pectoris and allied states. In this paper, he says that for most patients, diet is the central point of treatment, and that in convalescence or the more chronic stages of coronary artery disease, quiet, steady exercise is to be encouraged. Again, in 1907, a Russian writer put forward the suggestion that butter and eggs predispose to the formation of plaques and clots. Truly, it makes one feel that there is no new thing under the sun. The incidence of coronary artery disease is quite distinct from the incidence of coronary atheroma. Indeed, Morris has shown that atheroma of the coronary artery tree was as prevalent, if not more prevalent, 50 years ago than it is today. But we all know that coronary artery disease is greatly increased, nor does it seem to be a function of the intake of fats of all kinds. Except in certain familial cases, dietary fat in humans does not affect the level of blood cholesterol. The Maasai tribe in Africa takes a high proportion of animal fats in their diet, but coronary artery disease is unknown. They are an active and virile race, and this may have an important bearing on their immunity from this condition. Increase in carbohydrate intake, protein intake, and consequently total calorie intake has also risen with increase of general prosperity, and the rise in incidence of coronary artery disease seems to go hand in hand with this. It may have to do with the progressively less physical labor that is done, and indeed, one worker has shown that the rise in coronary artery disease is precisely paralleled by the increase in television licenses per annum. It may be related in like manner to the increasing number of cars and more rapid and efficient public transport, with all its accompanying tensions and frustrations when driving. There have always been stresses of all kinds, and several workers have shown that there is no definite relationship between the amount of measurable stress and the incidence of coronary artery disease. It seems to relate more to the individual's response to his own particular stresses. Others believe, too, that the relationship of smoking with coronary artery disease is more a function of the patient's psychological makeup than the effects of nicotine. A theory that is actively being investigated at present is that, and that is very attractive in many ways, is that there is an interference with the formation, utilization, or destruction of heparin in the bloodstream of those patients who are more than usually prone to coronary artery disease. This is associated with an increased stickiness of the platelets, and thrombi are built up and deposited on the endothelium of blood vessels at certain sites. These deposits gradually enlarge and are slowly converted into atheromatous plaques. Progression of the condition leads to arterial obstruction, beyond which slowing of the bloodstream can allow actual thrombosis of blood to occur, a very different mechanism from that of the laying down of the platelets. This tends to support the arguments against the use of long-term anticoagulants for prophylaxis against arterial thrombosis. It has always been recognized, even by the strongest protagonists of anticoagulant therapy, that further thrombosis can occur in the blood vessels, even when therapy with anticoagulants was very completely controlled. Anticoagulants only control one phase of clotting, and that not completely. Heparin, however, has a very different action and the results shown when it was used, even in small doses prophylactically, were very encouraging. These ideas may well prove to be much nearer the truth, but of course, this is said whenever a fresh approach is made. In this case, however, it fits in with a large number of otherwise unconnected facts. It may be mentioned that the idea that thrombin was laid down on artery walls and were converted into atheromatous plaques was postulated by Rokitansky about 100 years ago. Certain conditions are recognized as having a special association with coronary artery disease, namely diabetes, hypercholesterolemia, and hypertension. Women are said to be protected to a great degree before the menopause by the higher levels of estrogen in the bloodstream, but they are at equal risk in the later years of life. In this connection, it is interesting to note that two comparable series of men who had had a single coronary thrombosis were given estrogens for as long as 5 years. It seemed to make no difference, however, to their morbidity or their mortality from coronary artery disease. Coronary artery disease is present in the vast majority of adults, but it only manifests itself when it results in an inadequate supply of blood to the myocardium for the heart to function properly. This produces either symptoms or objective evidence of damage, or usually both. The symptoms may be acute, subacute, or chronic. For practical purposes, acute and subacute cases can be grouped together, as they mark a sudden change in the blood flow to the heart. Even when this change is small, it can result in sudden death, and this possibility must be borne in mind when prognosis and treatment are considered. You are all familiar with the anatomical background, and I only show this first diagram, number one, to bring out one or two points bearing on diagnosis and prognosis. The anastomotic connections between the right and left main coronary arteries increase with age. As a consequence of this, an area of infarcted muscle will have a better chance of recovery in more elderly people. But in view of the more extensive disease usually present, the ultimate prognosis in their cases will be worse. Younger patients, however, are more prone to succumb to the immediate attack. Once that is passed, their long-term prognosis is sometimes not very different from others of the same age group. Indeed, insurance companies are now willing to take people who are well and who have survived an infarct for a year or more, with a certain loading, of course. The other point that emerges from the diagram is the presence of a small lateral branch of the left coronary artery. If this is obstructed, the usual leads of the electrocardiogram may not be altered, whereas leads from the chest, a space or two above the usual position, may show classical changes of infarction. The second diagram shows, in a simplified way, the blood flow between the muscle fibers in the heart wall, with the arterioles and capillaries and venous sinuses lying between the layers of the myocardium. It is evident that the layers of muscle nearer the endocardium are under increasingly greater pressure during systole. The pressure is built up from without, inwards, towards the endocardium, with each layer of contracting muscle. The pressure at the endocardium, of course, equals the systolic blood pressure. It is also at the deeper levels that the blood vessels are most completely empty during systole, due to the contraction of the surrounding muscle. There is some flow during this phase in the outer layers, as the systolic pressure in the vessels there is greater than the pressure exerted by the outer layers of the myocardium alone. Thus, any ischemic effect is felt most severely in the subendocardial layers, or may be scattered in the deeper layers, depending on the local cellular needs and blood flow. The second point bears on treatment. There are minute intercapillary anastomoses that are functionally of little significance until they enlarge. This enlargement may be produced by increasing anoxia or by increasing pressure within this system. The pressure and the anoxia can be increased by obstructing the venous outflow. Some surgical methods of treatment for improving the blood flow makes use of these facts. The formation of an adequate anastomosis may take up to 3 weeks, and that is why it is so important to keep these patients at rest for this length of time. It may make the difference to survival of an area of myocardium whose blood supply is critical. To allow the patient to exercise or to be up and about, to use his myocardium in this state may induce such a degree of anoxia in the threatened muscle as to cause death of tissue that might otherwise have survived. The results of acute coronary thrombosis or occlusion depend on the size of the artery and the efficiency of the collateral anastomosis. I shall not describe a typical attack, but point out some of the difficulties that arise when an attack does not conform to the usual pattern. In one series of 266 cases that came to autopsy, only 44% of the diagnoses were correct. 52 of the cases were not even suspected of having infarction. In rare cases, pain may be absent altogether. The event may then be marked by sudden shock, an attack of faintness or unconsciousness without apparent cause, or an acute attack of breathlessness. This last symptom may be due to left heart failure. Left heart failure may produce a gradually developing pleural effusion whose presence is quite unsuspected, or it may lead on to congestive heart failure. With silent infarcts, as well as with overt ones, an embolus may form on the affected endocardium of the left ventricle overlying the affected muscle, and this may become dislodged, causing an acute arterial obstruction. The block may take place in a cerebral vessel or in one supplying a limb. Sudden arterial emboli, whose cause is not evident, should therefore be an indication to take an electrocardiogram. Coronary thrombosis may be overlooked in association with anesthesia and operation, and also when they occur in psychotics. In the first group, they may occur when the patient is unconscious. Then, on recovery, an undue degree of shock may be present, out of proportion to the operation performed. A low blood pressure, or excessive weakness, or heart failure may lead one to suspect the cause. After operation, the pain of infarction may be confused with that following the operation, particularly if its site is in the upper abdomen. If occurring a few days after the operation, it may be mistaken for a pulmonary embolus. In this case, an electrocardiogram taken in the acute phase can suggest a posterior infarct, but the chest leads will clarify the situation. When there is mental derangement, the assessment of the history, if the patient can supply one, is very difficult, and the whole episode may be completely missed or misconstrued. Pain may be present, but in an influenza epidemic, for instance, I have seen the picture mistaken for bronchopneumonia. There may be a temperature of 101 or 102 due to the infarct. There may be dyspnea with cough and crepitations at the bases, the latter being caused by left heart failure, and the clinical picture is very suggestive of a possible bronchopneumonia. Again, even with pain, the patient may be restless or may make little of it. This is especially liable to occur in the distress caused by acute left ventricular failure. On examination, the blood pressure may be normal or even raised, and the electrocardiogram may be unchanged. This state of affairs can go on for 12 to 24 hours and be very misleading. One must rely on one's clinical judgment, and if one has any doubt, prefer to say that it is an infarct rather than take risks in the acute phase. The blood pressure will drop within 24 hours or so, but one may have to wait longer, even up to 10 or 14 days in extreme cases, for the electrocardiogram to show any supporting evidence. When one suspects that infarction has occurred and the story is not typical, concomitant findings are usually present that confirm the diagnosis. When the infarct is large, fever, shock, and leukocytosis may be present. These occur to a much less degree in small infarcts, but in these the electrocardiogram may be altered and particular enzymes are found in abnormal amount in the bloodstream. The enzymes usually sought for are serum glutamic oxaloacetic transaminase and lactic dehydrogenase. The first of these reaches its peak in 24 to 36 hours, then rapidly falls to normal. It must be borne in mind that the level of this enzyme is also raised in the presence of damage to liver, muscle, kidney, and brain tissue. When the rise is due to an acute coronary thrombosis, it gives a fairly good estimation of the amount of myocardium damage. Lactic dehydrogenase can be found for as long as a week after the infarct and is very useful from this point of view. Changes in the electrocardiogram can clinch the diagnosis even when the history is unhelpful. When the site is unusual, however, as for instance when it occurs in the interventricular septum or high on the lateral or posterior wall, the tracing may be difficult to interpret or it may even be unchanged. When the arterial obstruction has caused only scattered subendocardial necrosis and not a through-and-through infarct, the only cardiographic change may be a depression of the ST segment and inversion of T over the lateral wall of the left ventricle. Diagram 3 gives such an instance. These changes are also produced by the reversible ischemic effect in angina pectoris. Once the muscle has recovered from its ischemia, a much more normal tracing is shown. A similar change, that is, a depression in the ST segment and inversion of T, can also occur in left ventricular hypertrophy. The changes produced by left bundle branch block can obscure the changes of infarction and make the interpretation of the tracing very difficult. When former myocardial damage due to earlier infarction is present, the tracing due to fresh infarction may be very atypical and again very difficult to read. Cardiographic changes, therefore, are not always as helpful as one would expect, and then one must rely again on one's clinical judgment. It is better to wait a few days when supporting evidence may develop that may confirm or perhaps refute the diagnosis. A rise in temperature or a rise in leukocyte count or in the blood sedimentation rate, changes in the electrocardiogram and fluctuations in the enzyme level must all be looked for. In cases of doubt, it is wiser to err on the cautious side when considering an acute episode and await events. By an acute episode, one means an evident or even doubtful coronary thrombosis, a sudden onset of angina, or the sudden worsening of angina, or the onset of angina at rest. In these cases, sudden death is possible at any time due to cardiac arrest or ventricular fibrillation. These may develop due to electrical changes across the margin between the fully oxygenated and inadequately oxygenated muscle at the edge of the infarcted myocardium. The area of damage may be very slight, and prompt action at this time can save life. These are the hearts that have been described as too good to die. External cardiac massage and artificial respiration must be used until it is decided by cardiography whether standstill or fibrillation of the myocardium is present, and then the appropriate action is taken. A fibrillating heart must be rendered inactive before normal activity can be restored. If standstill is present, spontaneous reactivation may occur on commencing external cardiac massage. Of course, if the damage is extensive, if congestive failure is present, it is useless to persevere in such efforts. One must now consider the conditions that can simulate infarction. Originally, the danger was that infarction may be missed, but today, everyone is so heart conscious that people are in far greater danger of being misdiagnosed as heart cases when they are in fact quite healthy. A mistake once made, and even rectified when made, can convert a normal person into a cardiac invalid. Three conditions stand out in this respect. Cervical osteoarthrosis or fibrositis, with reference of pain to the chest wall and down the arms, is very common and can simulate cardiac pain. It is not related to effort, however, although it may mislead one by coming on when a patient uses his arms. The pain is often stabbing or like pins and needles, especially down to the arms and fingertips, and such pain is never caused by cardiac ischemia. This is essentially the pain of root irritation. The pain of cardiac ischemia is constant, boring, burning, aching, crushing, but never intermittent, tingling, or stabbing. This referred type of pain often comes on when sitting in a high back chair when the neck is awkwardly placed, and indeed it can be induced by similar positions in bed. When this occurs in patients who are being nursed for cardiac infarction, one has to decide if extension of the infarct is taking place. An X-ray may be of no help, as cervical spondylosis is common among people with coronary artery disease as well as in those without it, and one has to make the decision on other grounds. The second condition is hiatus hernia and associated dyspeptic symptoms, in particular gastric and esophageal flatulence and irregular contractions of the lower esophagus. The nerve supply of these parts is common to the cardiac muscle as well, and the pain can simulate heart pain very precisely, even to its areas of reference. Again, the condition has to be cited clinically, as they may coexist with heart disease. The pain is not induced by effort, and when it simulates a cardiac infarct, as it might do very exactly, there are no supporting pathological findings, for instance, in the enzyme changes or in the electrocardiogram. As a rule, too, the attacks are repeated too often for them to be infarcts, and there is no consequent cumulative cardiac damage. When, however, a patient has had a coronary thrombosis or angina and also has a hiatus hernia, it can lead to a very distressing situation, as the patient becomes alarmed by any pain in that area. The last is a cardiac neurosis with a dragging or pressing pain, usually in the left chest, over the heart, as they say, but it may be very intense indeed and be accompanied by pain in the left shoulder or radiating down the left arm. With the associated fear, it may present a very impressive or alarming picture. It may be caused by an acute emotional crisis, or it may follow a smoldering emotional cause lasting many years. All of these may accompany true cardiac disease, and continuous vigilance is essential in every case. There are numerous other conditions that may be mistaken for cardiac infarction, but they are not so difficult to distinguish or so frequent as the ones I have mentioned. A common diagnosis in earlier days was prolonged angina. Any ischemic cardiac pain lasting longer than half an hour should be treated as infarction, even if one considers it to be due to that rather ill-defined condition of acute coronary insufficiency. It should still be treated as a small infarct. A pulmonary embolus may be present with acute chest pain, dyspnea, shock, and cyanosis. The neck veins are usually engorged, the pulmonary second sound is very loud, and the electrocardiogram does not show the usual changes. In the acute stage, this may suggest the presence of an acute posterior infarct, but the chest leads shows the presence of acute right ventricular stress and clarifies the position. An acute arrhythmia, especially when coronary artery disease is present, may induce a severe chest discomfort, which, if the arrhythmia continues, may increase and be associated with palpitations, sweating, a fall in blood pressure, and a sense of impending death. It may be impossible to be sure that infarction has not occurred until the rhythm has been restored to normal, when an electrocardiogram will decide what has happened. An ischemic pattern may be seen for an hour or so after a prolonged attack, but it rapidly improves. This should be borne in mind, however, when making up one's mind as to what has induced the arrhythmia. The history of a spontaneous pneumothorax may be very misleading. There is chest pain, which may continue and increase, increasing dyspnea, a progressive fall in blood pressure and rise in pulse rate, and even sweating and cyanosis if tension begins to build up in the pneumothorax. The physical signs and x-ray of the chest and the absence of cardiographic changes will clear up the diagnosis. Other chest conditions are pleurisy and the onset of pneumonia, and as I have mentioned earlier, the presence of bronchopneumonia. All these can give rise to difficulties. At its onset, a dissecting aneurysm of the aorta can cause difficulty too, but in this, however, there may be hypertension that persists. The site of pain may be more widespread, and peripheral changes and interference of blood flow develops. Thus, there may be transient blindness, or paresthesia, or weakness in the limbs. The pulses may be unequal or become obliterated, or there may be hematuria. The electrocardiogram does not show the usual changes unless one of the coronary arteries is compressed by cephalic spread of the dissection. Acute pericarditis with temperature, chest pain, and cardiographic changes can also lead to difficulties, and this can be dangerous. As a rule, recovery from this condition is to be expected without complications, but if mistaken for an infarct and treated with anticoagulants, the inflamed pericardium may bleed and cardiac tamponade and death may result from this treatment. Herpes zoster should be mentioned as a differential diagnosis. Also, heart failure. Rapid enlargement of the liver with consequent pain in the upper abdomen and chest and the signs of failure have been mistaken for infarction. Acute upper abdominal emergencies, such as perforation of a peptic ulcer or gallbladder colic, may present difficulties as well. These are the main pitfalls in diagnosis, but despite their number, a careful history and meticulous examination, the progress of the patient over a few hours, and the judicious use of the ancillary means of diagnosis at one's disposal catch the vast majority in their net. Some escape and may lead to tragedy, but constant care is one's only safeguard against them.
We should like to thank Smith, Klein and French Laboratories Limited for their generosity in paying for the cost of this recording. This recording was produced by the Medical Recording Service of the College of General Practitioners.